the great good fortune to get to be here for them when neither can be here. And I will be here a fair amount. Sorry about this. I need to fix this. As Sylvia is just entering her sabbatical, I will be here, I think, five different times between now and Thanksgiving. So I'm excited. I'll be here. So today, and then I'll be here again in 2 weeks, end of September, and then a couple of times in November. So that will be a very sweet opportunity for me to get to know you better, and for you to get to know me a little bit better also. I live in Arcata, which is 300 miles north of here, and I teach there regularly. I teach Dharma classes, I teach mindfulness in organizations, all different kinds of ways, and I also like to lead wilderness meditation retreats during the spring to fall seasons. So that is me, and I love the ritual in our class in this Wednesday morning Sangha of getting to know each other a little bit, who's here, who hasn't been here before. So I wonder if there is anybody for whom this is the first time you've come to Spirit Rock. Wow, wonderful, thank you. Would you be willing to introduce yourselves? Would that be okay? Anybody who's willing, please stand up and tell me your name and where you're here from.
My name is Leslie Fisher, and I drove up from San Francisco. I've driven by innumerable times on the way to Point Reyes. I've never turned in, so I'm very excited to be here.
Well, great. So what made you turn in today?
I came with my friends who have come in the past.
Great. Welcome, Leslie. I'm really glad you're here. Who else would like to introduce themselves? Yes. Welcome, Suzanne. So what brings you here? Excellent. Nice way to spend the morning. Welcome. Who else would like to introduce themselves? Yes.
My name is Anna Fell. I'm new to Brandon, and I have driven by here numerous times.
I'm so glad you did. Was there something special that inspired you today? Good reason. Perfect. Have you ever meditated?
No.
Okay, well, welcome. Welcome. Yes, please. Oh, Yvonne.
Okay.
Yes. Thanks, Yvonne. Great. Cindy, is this your first time too?
Yes, it's my first time here. I'm from Lafayette, and I've heard about Spirit Rock for a long time.
Welcome. Great. I'm so glad. Good. I think there's somebody back there in the corner. There you are. Welcome. Nice date. Nice date. Welcome. Anybody else? All right. Okay. So the way we will spend our time together is we'll talk with each other, and I'll talk a little bit this morning before we meditate, maybe 15 minutes or so, and then we'll have a meditation. And for the meditation, I actually, because some of us are new to meditation, I will give some maybe a little deeper instructions than I may otherwise give, and really as a way to welcome everybody into practice. And so if you are an experienced practitioner, just let it come in. Let those beginning instructions come in. You might hear something you haven't heard before. And as always, we really try to come into each time of practice together with a beginner's mind. And that is the mind that says, I don't know what this is going to be like today. It's the mind that just comes in fresh, because we have never in this configuration all been here together at this time. It's likely we never will again to have exactly the same people at the same, in the same configuration. So let's just all come into it with a sense of newness. And then we will meditate. At the end of the meditation, we will have a break. And then we'll have a Dharma talk at 11. My request is that during the meditation, try not to leave the room. Even if you are feeling restless, just open your eyes. If you just open your eyes, but stay. But try to stay. So one of the rituals in this group also that I really appreciate, that I don't get to come here that much because I live a ways away, but I do listen to the class every time the class is posted on Dharma Seed. So I try to keep up with what's happening in class. And I know that there is a ritual of introducing yourselves to each other, to those whom you're sitting beside. And so I would really like to do that, that if you can just turn to somebody who's close by and introduce yourself. But before you do it, wait. Hang on. There's one little extra instruction. Not only just saying, hi, this is my name, and, you know, this is why I'm here, or something like that. If you could share something that you find particularly joyful, something that you find uplifting for you in your heart, in your life. What lifts your spirit? And we'll take a couple minutes and go ahead and introduce yourself and share that, please. All right, let's come back. Did you like that? How do you feel? Exactly. You know, there are a lot of difficulties in our world, and we all know that. And it is extremely important to remember what lifts you, and to know that there's something that lifts the heart of each one of us, and that when we share that, we get a vicarious hit. And that is important, certainly in any time of our lives, but certainly in times of great stress and strife. It's important to recognize how you feel also, because it strengthens the brain. It strengthens the neural pathways in the brain that influence our feelings of well-being. So when we talk about what makes us feel good, what brings us joy, what is beautiful, we are stimulating that place. And the reason that when I just said, so how do you feel? Everybody said, good, joyful. Because that's what's happening. And so we need to be reminded of that. And this is certainly not instead of recognizing the difficulties, because this is normal, this is just true. But this is a really important part of ourselves. So today we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about perspective and capacity and joy. I like to think about it as joy as an act of resistance. That's the title of our time together today, is how do we tap into joy to know there's more to me, there's more to what's around us than the difficulties, and how do we tend to what we love? And when we tend to what we love, it actually plants the seeds for joy, and that enables us to be with what is difficult. That gives us a deeper foundation, a deeper capacity. So I want to start with a story. It's not a story, actually. It's a piece from Carl Sagan. And I love this. You may know it. Anybody familiar with the pale blue dot? Okay. See, there's a smile. You know it. It's great, isn't it? So this, I'll read this to you. We'll talk about it a little bit. This is an excerpt from Carl Sagan's book, The Pale Blue Dot, and it was inspired by an image taken at his suggestion by Voyager 1 on February 14, 1990. As the spacecraft left our planetary neighborhood for the fringes of the solar system, engineers turned it around for one last look at our home planet. Voyager 1 was about 6.4 billion kilometers, that's 4 billion miles away, and approximately 32 degrees above the ecliptic plane when it captured a portrait of our world. Caught in the center of scattered light rays, the result of taking a picture so close to the sun, the Earth appears as a tiny point of light, a crescent only 0.12 pixels in size. Now, if you've seen this picture, it's this vertical beam of light that you know how it looks when you see dust in sunlight. So this was this big vertical beam of light in space, and there's this tiny blue dot in there, and the tiny blue dot is us. It's the Earth. Earth appears as a tiny point of light, only a crescent of just a little piece of this point of a pixel. And then Sagan says, look at that dot. That's here. That's home. That's us. On it, everyone you love, everyone you know, everyone you ever heard of, every human being who ever was lived out their lives. The aggregate of our joy and suffering, thousands of confident religions, ideologies, and economic doctrines, every hunter and forager, every hero and coward, every creator and destroyer of civilization, every king and peasant, every young couple in love, every mother and father, hopeful child, inventor and explorer, every teacher of morals, every corrupt politician, every superstar, every supreme leader, every saint and sinner in the history of our species lived there, on a mote of dust, suspended in a sunbeam. The Earth is a very small stage in a vast cosmic arena. Think of the rivers of blood spilled by all those generals and emperors so that in glory and triumph they could become the momentary masters of a fraction of a dot. Think of the endless cruelties visited by the inhabitants of one corner of this pixel on the scarcely distinguishable inhabitants of some other corner. How frequent their misunderstandings, how eager they are to kill one another, how fervent their hatreds. Our posturings, our imagined self-importance, the delusion that we have some privileged position in the universe are challenged by this point of pale light. Our planet is a lonely speck in the great enveloping cosmic dark. In our obscurity, in all this vastness, there's no hint that help will come from elsewhere to save us from ourselves. The Earth is the only world known so far to harbor life. There is nowhere else, at least in the near future, to which our species could migrate. Visit, yes. Settle, not yet. Like it or not, for the moment, the Earth is where we make our stand. It's been said that astronomy is a humbling and character-building experience. There's perhaps no better demonstration of the folly of human conceits than this distant image of our tiny world. To me, it underscores our responsibility to deal more kindly with one another and to preserve and cherish the pale blue dot, the only home we've ever known. Perspective, right? That piece of we are just a mote of dust in a sunbeam. What are we doing? And I don't say that as a dire clarion call. I say it as, what are we doing? Okay, let's really all show up and tap into that place in us where we feel most supported, where we feel most alive, where hopefully we are doing the work personally and professionally that makes us be alive and feel alive in our lives. Because when we do that, we have more capacity. We have more capacity to respond to the violence and injustices that are around us. It was striking to me when I was looking back at my notes. The last time I was here offering teachings for this Wednesday class was last fall, right after the shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh. And I thought, well, how ironic this is that I'm now coming here again a few days later after this same thing. And I thought, you know, I just can't talk about that again, which is part of my inspiration for let's talk about what lifts our hearts, what really supports us. And it is important to remind ourselves from our Buddhist practice about our commitment to non-harming. And that includes how we take refuge, that place we find of reliable safety, where we know we can come and feel secure. And when that gets compromised, it's hard. But this reliable safety is often an internal place. So when we say we take refuge in the Buddha, we take refuge in that capacity in ourselves to tap into our deepest wisdom. That's one way to look at it. We take refuge in the Dharma, the teachings, what the Buddha taught, what we know to be true, our practices. Practicing joy is taking refuge in the Dharma. And we take refuge in the Sangha. Should we show up here together? You know, 50 people come on a Wednesday morning to meditate together and settle their minds and open their hearts, us. So we get reminded about that, certainly in difficult times, but we also can get reminded about that when we're just going along and there's actually nothing that feels earth-shattering that is in our immediate consciousness. So I think that that's an important thing to remember. And we also use our precepts, the precepts of non-harming, which basically say, I undertake a training to take good care of myself and those around me. And those are comprised of choosing to honor life, not willingly taking life. Honoring that we offer our resources. We show up with our presence, with our kindness, with our hearts, instead of taking what doesn't belong to us, but we offer instead. We are careful with our speech. We get to know how this works so that our conversations and the language we use come from a kind heart, not from a place of vitriol or with any intent to harm. We're careful with the energies of our bodies so we don't harm another through our sexuality or our energies, and we also take care of ourselves in that way. And we also watch our consumerism. And when the Buddha taught this, this came out of not consuming intoxicants. But we can see how media can be an intoxicant, shopping can be an intoxicant. Whatever we take in to an excess that doesn't support our well-being. So it's very helpful in difficult times to remember the refuges, to remember commitment to non-harming, and to over and over and over again reflect on what that means to each one of us individually. What does non-harming actually mean? And that can change over time. So it's a practice, it's a reflection. The same thing with going back to the precepts. What of these commitments to non-harming do we need to work on? What is something that we've actually really deeply cultivated that now comes a little more naturally to us? So that is one very real and tangible way to respond to the violence that we see around us, is to remember our own commitments, however that works for you. But the Buddha gave us this structure of the refuges and the precepts. I repeat all of that because as I looked back in my notes of what I talked about the last time I was here, and it was post-Pittsburgh, that was what we spent the entire time talking about. But I want to talk about joy today because I think that it is a really, really important way to also support our ability to be present in our lives. Any questions on that? Anything you want to comment on before we go into our meditation? Okay, all right. So we will have a meditation, let's see, probably about 20, 25 minutes, so we'll have plenty of time to settle in. So whatever you need, posture-wise, support-wise, find chairs, cushions, whatever you want. You know, the other thing that I think helps support our perspective and our capacity is when we remember that we really are a mote of dust in a sunbeam. And then our stuff maybe becomes a little less important, even though our stuff is important. But when we get bigger perspective, some of the smaller things that annoy us maybe don't have to annoy us so much. All right, so let's settle into our bodies, finding a comfortable posture, holding just enough energy to stay alert and upright. And when I say upright, what I mean is a brightness of mind, this alertness of mind. And if you are upright physically, feel that energy moving up from the base up to the crown. If you're lying down, perfectly acceptable meditation posture, there's still an uprightness of mind that is available. So let's begin by sensing the body sitting just as you are. Awareness of the body. There is a body. Noticing the feet. Are they touching the earth? Whatever your posture is, sensing down into the feet. Becoming aware of the legs. And how the legs attach at the hips and the groin to the bottom. Feel the places where the body is making contact with whatever you're sitting on. We don't often think about those touch points, the contact points, and what they actually feel like. There may be a sense of pressure, of warmth. Maybe there's a sense of hardness. And if you feel comfortable, noticing what does comfort feel like? Noticing the hands, however they are, whether they are touching the thighs or resting gently in the lap, however you like to have your hands, notice them. Is there a sense of temperature? Sometimes the hands can, there can be a pulsing, maybe a vibration. Just becoming aware of the hands as if from the inside out. And if you can allow your shoulders and arms to relax, the hands will relax naturally. And now become aware of the breathing. Begin by simply becoming aware of breathing. Breathe and know your breathing. You might notice the distinction between the in-breath and the out-breath, and the very slight pause before the next breath begins. Just sense the whole breath cycle. And now bringing to mind what you heard from the person you were talking with about what lifts their heart. And without going into a whole long repetition of the conversation, just that sparkle, just that seed, what did they tell you and what did you share with them? And can you feel the uplift of the heart-mind when you bring this back into your memory? Does it brighten the heart? Does it brighten the mind? From the ground of sensing the body, sensing the breath, and allowing our hearts to feel some happiness and joy and warmth. That's how we set the tone for our meditation. It adds some sweetness to it. You may find that there's a place in your own body where you feel your breath the most. It might be the deep belly or the chest as it moves with the inhale and exhale. Or maybe it's right at the nostrils where you sense the breath going in and out. Wherever you feel your breath the most, see if you can allow your awareness to settle right there and stay there, knowing that the mind will wander. And when it does and you've noticed it, come back. Come back to your breath where you feel it the most and begin again. And if your breath is not a place that's comfortable to rest your awareness, try resting your awareness in your hands. Whatever works most easily for you, that's your spot. And we'll sit quietly now. As we continue to sit quietly, I'll offer you a little bit of a guided practice, beginning with bringing to mind what you love. Can you bring to mind something that just fills you? Sense into this quality of perhaps tenderness or softness. When you bring this to mind, how does that feel inside of you? Sensing the breath as you breathe. And bring the awareness to the heart center. This area of the center of the chest. If that's how you sense your own heart center, or wherever that might be for you. And feel the breath coming and going. And if you'd like, imagine or sense breathing in and out of the heart as if you are breathing fresh air into the heart center from in front of the heart, behind the heart, above and below, side to side, and all the diagonals. So you breathe into the heart space from every direction, filling the heart. And as you breathe out, as you exhale, also back out into every direction, allowing the heart to soften, become a little more spacious. And in that, our capacity grows, the capacity of the heart. This is the heart's breath, breathing into the heart from every direction, breathing back out into every direction. Try that for a few breaths. And then if you like, offering yourself a beautiful blessing. May my happiness grow. May it continue. And if it's helpful to bring that thing to mind that you know supports you, that lifts your heart, that you love, bring that to mind. May my happiness grow. May it continue. Now bringing somebody to mind who you would like to offer this same blessing to. Anybody in your life who comes to mind as the right person. May your happiness grow. May it continue. And if you can't choose, don't worry about it. Whoever shows up represents everybody else. May your happiness grow. May it continue. And widening out again, imagining all of us sitting together this morning in this beautiful room. Showing up with our whole hearts. May our happiness grow. May it continue. May it support us. sensing back into the body, feeling right where you are right now. This is a poem from Ross Gay. It's called Thank You. If you find yourself half naked and barefoot in the frosty grass, hearing again the earth's great sonorous moan that says you are the heir of the now and gone, that says all you love will turn to dust and will meet you there, do not raise your fist. Do not raise your small voice against it, and do not take cover. Instead, curl your toes into the grass, watch the cloud ascending from your lips, walk through the garden's dormant splendor, say only thank you, thank you. So opening your eyes, letting the light back in, arriving in this room. Let's take about 10 minutes. We'll take a break, stretch, walk, come back, and then we'll talk with each other. And I'll be here if anybody has any questions for me. Welcome back. So I'm curious, for those who are here new to meditation, how did that go? It was relaxing. Were you able to hold your attention? Sure. Yeah. Good. Vaughn, no, huh? Yeah, normal. Really normal. Yeah. Anybody else have any feedback? Went okay, huh? Good. I'm glad. This is from Kurt Vonnegut. He says, please notice when you're happy and exclaim or murmur or think at some point, if this isn't nice, I don't know what is. You know, we're so often looking for the next thing, aren't we? That we forget to notice that actually sitting here right now in this space, this is pretty nice. And how lucky we are to have this beautiful space that we've all decided to come together on this day to sit quietly, to talk about the Dharma, to just be with each other. And it may have been enormous effort on some of our parts to get here and to recognize that and not to take that for granted. It's not a small thing necessarily to get here and to give yourself some pat on the back, well done, and how much I think we all know that we need each other to do this. And for some of us, we may have driven across the street. It was a little bit easier. Truly, you know, that's true. And it's just really important to notice, if this isn't nice, I don't know what is. It doesn't have to be this big explosion. So I want to keep talking about this theme of knowing when you got a good thing going. and this feeling of joy and what joy is, and to expand the conversation a little deeper into capacity and perspective. It's really important to know our capacity at any given time, and sometimes we take things on that are a little bit too much, and sometimes not quite enough, and we work with that place of efforting, and is it striving, or is it just this way in which we fall into a rhythm? So one of the things that I think from the Buddha that is very important, that helps give us perspective and also supports our capacity, are what he taught as the three marks of experience. You might be familiar with this. Or we could call them three things that we know to be true. That's another way to think about it. It's like, yeah, look, like what do we know that actually is accurate? So what he shared is that these three things we know to be true, marks of experience, in the language of the Buddha, Pali, dukkha, anicca, and anatta. Dukkha is typically translated as sorrow or suffering. And I recently heard a really great way to define dukkha, suffering, as the experience of imperfection, that the world is just imperfect. And that, to me, was really a relief to think about it like that, because of course it's imperfect, because what's perfect anyway? We strive so much in our culture for some idea of what we think is perfect, and we're never going to get there. And then we struggle when we are living inside of what we think of as imperfection. And the struggle, when challenge and pain and difficulty becomes suffering, that's our rubbing up against it. That's our having contention with how we want things to be, but they're not that way. That's a great way to define suffering or this struggle. But when we recognize that it is just simply an imperfect world, and this is just how it is, does that feel easier to you to just say, yeah, well, of course? Then the struggle goes away. It's just not there. It might not be exactly how we want it. But, you know, there was a teaching from the third Zen patriarch in the Verses of the Faith Mind that says to be without anxiety about non-perfection. Isn't that great? Can we be without anxiety about non-perfection? Because when we do that, we get released from that. You know, if we can release the grip. So, first thing we know to be true is that the world is imperfect. And can we work to accept that as it is? Or to just acknowledge it and work with things to improve them or shift them so they are more workable, but not to fight that's just true. And the second one is anicca, which is impermanence. So we know that. And we know that everything is changing, that everything will change, that everything is truly never completely static, even though it might appear very static. It's actually not. We are changing all the time. I think it's every 7 years, all of the cells in our body are replaced. That's an amazing thing. So we're not the same person physically that we were 7 years ago. We may feel like we're the same person. We have the same personality. You know, we may not feel the aging of our minds and how we are in the world, but certainly we know firsthand the experience of the changing body. So everything is impermanent. And then the last one, anatta, which is not self, or the experience of that one thing leads to the next, to the next, to the next, because of this, that. There's a consequence to every action. There are causes that create conditions that are influenced by this cause and that cause, and because of that, there is nothing that is firmly solid, including ourselves. And we think there's a solid me in here. And yeah, of course there is my perception of myself, but it is a continually changing process. And one of my favorite ways of relating to not self is this truth that, I think this is true, that most things that happen in the world are not personal. It's not about me. Now, we're all quite self-referential, and we think we're at the center of our lives, and probably we are for practical purposes. But the fact that there might be a decision that gets made that it within our organization, perhaps, that affects us positively or negatively or neutrally, maybe it has some ripple effect. It's not personal. It's just what's happening. So the more we can see that things that happen are a result of so many other things that happen, there's less struggle. And I think that's what the Buddha was pointing to about understanding these three marks of existence or these three things that are reliably true, that it's an imperfect world, it is impermanent, and it is impersonal. Do you like that? I like that a lot. When I heard that, I thought, you know, that's just such a great way to talk about suffering and impermanence and conditionality. That when my stuff gets less, when it shrinks, I guess that's the best word, when it shrinks down, I'm freer. Because I'm just not so caught in what I think of everything or how I want it to be. But we also know that within the context of dukkha, the experience of struggle, the experience of difficulty and challenge, the truth of impermanence, sometimes impermanence is welcome, right? Thank God for impermanence. This too will change. Sometimes it's not welcome. Right? Sometimes we lose things. We lose relationships. We lose homes. We lose jobs. There are shifts that happen that are extremely painful. And when we realize I am the recipient of cause and effect, and I don't like how it lands, I don't really like that. Like, there may be a consequence to my experience or my life that I'd rather not have. But it's really not about me. How we respond to these truths, to these realities, the other thing that we have in our continual acclimation, we are continually acclimating to our lives and accommodating whatever our circumstances are. We can actually rely on the heart. There are aspects of the heart and heart practices from the perspective of this practice that we also know to be true. The three marks of experience also are balanced with or responded to with all of our heart practices. The four primary ones, the Brahmaviharas, the practice of loving kindness, metta, the warm heart, the practice of compassion, the practice of appreciative joy, mudita, and the continual practice of equanimity. And of course, the practices of generosity and gratitude and empathy and forgiveness. All of these aspects of the heart that we really need to bring into our lives as responses to the difficulties we experience, the truth of change, and the truth that these things are going to happen no matter whether I like it or not. So that's not to say that we are raising a white flag of the kind of surrenders that is not accepting, that just sort of lays back and takes it. I don't mean that. I mean that we have ways of responding to this that come from the heart. So a quick definition of each of these Brahmaviharas, and then we're going to focus on joy. Metta. Metta is the Pali word that's often translated as loving kindness. It's the warm friendliness of the heart. It is that capacity to tend to what we love, to see the goodness in another, to show up with this unobstructed heart. It's that feeling that you get when you see a friend and it makes your heart go wah, wah, wah. You know, that feeling that bubbles up. That's metta. My favorite definition comes from John Peacock. He's a Pali scholar, a British teacher, scholar. He says the best translation of metta is to grow fat with friendliness. Isn't that great? Can we grow fat with friendliness? That is metta. And that can take some work because some things obstruct it. But this is what the heart starts responding, how the heart starts working, and how we lead with our heart. Compassion. Compassion is that capacity to care. The movement of the heart. When we are, I think that one of the classic definitions is the quivering in the heart, quivering of the heart in the presence of pain. When the heart meets love, when the heart meets pain, love arises. That's compassion. That is a little bit more of an active form of metta when we can actually turn towards the pain of another or the pain of ourselves and actively care, help in some way. That's a way to think of compassion. Joy, mudita, appreciative joy. This is the ability to rejoice for somebody else's success, to be happy for somebody else's happiness that has nothing to do with us. And we'll talk more about that in a minute. And the fourth is equanimity, upekkha. And this is balance. This is the ability to flow with what is happening and not lose our bearings. Or when we do lose our bearings through our practice, we cultivate some resiliency, this capacity to bounce back after difficult times. That's equanimity. All of these are a continual, ongoing practice. I don't think we're ever going to say, yep, got that. You know, is anybody there? I mean, this is, we're just human, and these are the things that we need to support us to manage the truth of difficulty, to manage everything is changing, and that it's really not about us. But I want to talk about joy and focus on it because I actually think that loving kindness and compassion get top billing mostly. Right? Don't we hear about that most? You know, where is your compassionate self? Find this loving kindness. But I think that the capacity to feel joy, and I don't mean Hallmark exuberant joy. I'm going to define it in a few ways for us. I mean that ability to feel this aliveness in life. I think that's the doorway into loving kindness. The doorway into compassion. If we can feel and rejoice, if we can rejoice for somebody else's success without the cloudiness of envy and jealousy and resentment, then that's this is the challenge of appreciative joy. We'll get to that. But if we can do that, and we can really feel that, we have gotten out of our own way. That is the not-selfness of it. And from there, I think we really can enter into deeper qualities of loving kindness and compassion because it's not clouded with our own stuff. The Buddha said that happiness is contentment with whatever there is. Now, from our Western view of what is happiness, that might not make sense. But what I believe he means by happiness with whatever there is, that means a capacity to accommodate whatever there is. We don't have to like it. We might struggle. We may find injustice everywhere. But it is the ability to say, right now it's like this. This is actually what's happening. It is not railing against it. It is working with it. Another way to define joy, this comes from Dr. Rachel Naomi Raymond. You might be familiar with her. She's a physician who started Commonweal, which is an organization that helps people manage cancer. And it's a Bay Area organization. This is how she defines joy. Joy seems to be part of an unconditional wish to live, not holding back because life may not meet our preferences or expectations. Joy seems to be a function of the willingness to accept the whole and to show up and meet whatever is there. The willingness to win or lose moves us out of an adversarial relationship to life and into a powerful kind of openness. From such a position, we can make a greater commitment to life, not only pleasant life or comfortable life or our idea of life, but all life. Joy seems to be more related to aliveness than happiness. And I think that that's where I want to get to with this, is that what joy does is gives us an avenue into, it is, I believe, almost always possible to find something good. It really is. To notice what is beautiful, to notice something very small, how the dandelions can come up through the cracks in the concrete. How is that possible, that will to live? I mean, really, I don't get that. You know, when we see weeds coming up through pavement, how is that the strength that has to be inside that, the fiber of a plant to do that? So maybe that's happiness, that's joy, that aliveness. And as I'm offering you this, this is just what I'm thinking about. And I am not in any way saying this is what's right. It's just for our reflection. This is what our Dharma practice asks, is can we think about these things and explore them and see how they work in our own lives. So I'm bringing this up because I'm finding in my own life that this quality of aliveness and joy, even in the midst of what can be heartbreaking, is possible. I mean, if you think about perhaps your own experiences in your life, some of the times that maybe have been the most challenging, the most unbelievable. And when I mean unbelievable, like, I can't believe this thing is happening. That's what I'm talking about. You know that tape that we have? Instead of being in the righteous outrage of what might be happening, but to have a little broader perspective to say, I can't believe this is happening. And then there's something else that happens within that. As we move through this, we can experience incredible sorrow. We can experience depths of loss we never imagined. And yet we can thrive. And that's the joy right there, is that we can grow up through the cracks of the concrete in the sidewalk. That despite the sorrows, there's something in us. Certainly not the same for all of us. Certainly impacted by our conditioning, our resiliency, our temperament, our genetics. But we have a capacity to thrive even in the midst of tragedy. Anybody notice that? Can we nod? And if that has not been your experience, to know that it's possible might be enough. Even if you feel like, well, that could never happen for me. It hasn't happened for me. To widen out the perspective enough to know that it can happen. And part of how it can happen is we show up in groups like this, where we sit quietly, where we talk about what's important with what supports us. So the Buddha taught that there were four kinds of joy. This is Dharma joy. And the first kind is meditative joy. That sense of settledness and calm, states of meditative absorption and concentration that lead to a sense of that beautiful energy that moves through us. Do you know what I'm talking about? It can be thought of as bliss energy, and it doesn't have to be rapturous, but that feeling when you sit down and meditate, and when the meditation is over, or maybe in the midst of it, and you become aware of, oh, this feels good. I am feeling settled. There's more spaciousness here, a little more capacity. That's meditative joy. Now, certainly, for some of us, some of us have experienced heights of meditative joy. That is called rapture. That is a piece of one of the seven factors of awakening, is rapture and joy. And these are these heightened states that they don't last, but they're very seductive because it can feel ecstatic in the body or in the mind or in the heart, where there's a lot of energy that is moving, that feels really good, that is actually a byproduct of the concentrated mind. So while I say that they're seductive, they are, because if that happens for you in meditation, it can feel like, oh, that's the point. That's what I'm supposed to be doing. And then we start having an agenda about, when I sit down to meditate, where's the rapture? And it can be really deflating when it doesn't happen anymore. So again, things are impermanent. But it's just one kind of joy, is this kind of happiness that can arise spontaneously from the concentrated, quiet mind. Wendell Berry says that happiness is the onset of unexpected good. Happiness is the onset of unexpected good. Isn't that just wonderful? Because sometimes things just happen that we least suspect. And that is enlivening. It boosts our confidence and our faith, I think, in life. That feeling of perhaps we've been in a difficult time and all of a sudden things get a little bit better. Like, how can I thrive in the midst of terror or loss or whatever it is? How can I actually feel that? But we do, because this is possible for us. This does happen. So that's the first kind of joy. Second kind, this is really sweet, the joy of understanding and realization. This is the aha moment. This is when you learn something new or you understand something a little more deeply. That's pretty cool, right? When you figure out the geometry problem. I mean, literally, it's like that. Or maybe you're cooking something new and you haven't done it before and it turns out great and you learn something about certain kinds of ingredients that go together, that worked. Just the deepening understanding of anything is a source of joy. And I think that we know that feeling. These are these mini awakenings that we have. If we can think of, I like to think of awakening or enlightenment as when I know something in a deeper way and it changes my perspective. I understand something more deeply. Sayadaw Tejaniya, who was a Burmese Theravadan monk, he said, "You should be happy when you know or understand anything." Isn't that great? Be happy when you know or understand anything. All right, that's the second kind of joy. Because it gives us perspective and it builds momentum. And this is really important. The third source of joy is our skillful action, our ethical conduct, how it feels to cultivate non-harming and to be in our lives from a place that we are actually intentionally setting our lives in a direction where we consciously say, I don't want to hurt myself or anybody else. That doesn't mean that we won't, but it means that that is our intention. So when we experience specifically states of non-greed, non-ill will, when we let go of the grudge we've been holding for a long time, there's freedom right in that. That's a source of joy. When we let go of the need for, I want this, I want this, oh my God, that's a really great pair of socks, I better go buy 5 of them. Yeah, maybe we don't have to do that. What happens when we let go of that? Those kinds of desires that keep us caught, those are the non-greed moments. When we know that we have enough, and I don't mean stuff, when we are enough, when we feel some amount of security in our daily lives, this leads to the capacity to live a more ethical life of non-harming, because we're not in constant states of wanting and graspiness. And I do think that that also includes the freeing up of how ill will lives in us. And all of us have parts have that in us. But every time we let go, or we notice that little scrap of ill will that's in there, and we go, whoa, oh, right, that's degrading my heart. I need to let that be, let that go. That brings on joy. That brings on the joy, the happiness of unexpected good arising. From the Metta Sutta, the Buddha's teaching on loving kindness, by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again in this world. So this line of, by not holding to fixed views, that's an incredibly important line, right? Do you have any fixed views? You know, this is, we have them. They are inside of us, those things that we might feel righteous about. I know this is the way it is. Boom. Well, is it true? Can we widen out that perspective? So when we are willing to consider the views of another, and it's going to be hard to do, it also frees us up, which is an aspect of joy and happiness. It's an act of generosity to let go of our fixed views. It brings some relief. And we can also feel joy when we remember the good things that we have done. And that might feel counterintuitive in our culture, but it is not conceited or arrogant to think of the good work that you have done. Kindness, generosity, the ways you show up as expressions of the good heart, the ability to offer yourself in different ways. There's a great story that one of our teachers, Joseph Goldstein, tells about his practice as a relatively young practitioner when he was in India, and he was practicing very diligently, and he was in a difficult cycle in his practice and feeling frustrated and restless and couldn't get back to where he had been as when he was in a smoother cycle. And he went to his teacher and said this, I can't quite get there. And I don't remember who the teacher was who said to him, remember your sila. Sila is the Pali word for ethical conduct. And he wasn't saying it as remember your sila, you know, like, you know, maybe you're having a hard time because you haven't behaved so well. It wasn't that, it was the direct opposite, which is remember your good heart. Remember your good intentions. That will support you in difficult times, whether it's on the cushion, going through a difficult cycle, or just in your life. When we can remember our innate goodness, it builds momentum and faith and confidence. And we need that. Fourth kind of joy is mudita. Isn't that just a great word? I love saying it, mudita, M-U-D-I-T-A. Mudita is what I said earlier, is this is appreciative joy, the capacity to feel happy for somebody else, for their success. So what gets in the way? What can you think of immediately? Just shout it out. Jealousy, is that what you said? Yeah. What else?
Self-concern.
Greed. Greed.
Pain.
Why not me? Why you? Right? How come you get all the good stuff? How come everything happens for you? Not me. This is why I think that mudita is the doorway in to loving kindness and compassion, because we have got to have our self-absorption in abeyance in order to do that. And it feels so good to feel happy for somebody else's success. And it's a little bit different than parental pride, as an example, because we sort of have something to do with the successes of our kids. I remember when my son was playing basketball. He started playing basketball from the time he was, like fourth or fifth grade in rec league, all the way up through playing varsity basketball in high school. But he was always a bench player. And if you were ever a bench player, or you were ever the parent of a bench player, you know that there's some inherent dukkha in that. Because what do we want more than anything is for our kids to succeed and to be proud of themselves and to get to be the one, right? To really be in the in group and feel really good about themselves. But when you're a bench player, you're on the support staff and you're going to get into a game sometimes. And it presents for us when we are on the B team or the bench, whatever it is, how can I want to do that too. You know, that can be really hard. I cannot tell you how many conversations we had with our son about trying to support him in who he was, and being a bench player didn't make him less than. So I spent a lot of time in the bleachers. A lot of time in the bleachers. Yeah. Okay, let me finish the story and then we'll go right there. So, Jacob is a very tall, tall, lanky kid. And I was sitting in the bleachers many, many hours. And this was in one of those crucial games where, I don't know who the teams were, but it was one of those crucial games. It was probably the local rival. And he actually got in the game in the fourth quarter, and it was the last few minutes of the game, and it was a tie game. And so everybody was on pins and needles. And he was a center, and the ball came flying over the court, and he just raised his hand, and he blocked the shot. And I leapt out of my chair. Yes, Jacob! And everybody looked around at me like this. I was like, my kid blocked the shot, and they're going to win the game. That's not quite mudita. That's parental exuberance. And I'm just telling you that because, I remember it. It happened a really long time ago. But it was one of those moments that it was such pure joy and such pure happiness. And I think he was only a little bit embarrassed. But we need that too. We need that too, because I know that we had so many conversations with him about, why not me? Why does that person get all the time? I'm actually pretty good. So how, when you're 15, 16, 17, can you be happy for your teammate that they're getting all the time? Or how can I, as the parent, be happy for that other parent who is, in Yiddish, kvelling, with all of the joy, really, really basking in it? So this is hard work. This is really hard work, this mudita, and this is why I think it's the crux of it. Yes, tell me your name. Kyle, right, here comes the microphone.
Okay, I did a mudita retreat with Carol Wilson, and she was talking about how, and she stressed and emphasized over and over again that it is best, just like with metta, to start with ourselves, mm-hmm. even with mudita, because mm-hmm. I know that we think of sympathetic joy as being happy for the other person, but it also does include ourselves in there, just as metta does, so that if we can show appreciation and gratitude for the small things in our own lives, then we have something to stand on, when we're extending that to someone else. So I think I whenever I think of mudita, I somehow don't always think of it as for the other person, but rather,
it's both, yeah. Kyle, you're absolutely correct. All of these practices are interconnected, and they all need each other to be fully expressed. And so when I say I think it's a doorway in, I do, for me personally. But I also know I need my metta practice as well. But you know, in that meditation that we did today, and we started with self, and I said, may my happiness grow, may it continue. That's the mudita practice that we were doing. And so we started with self so we could extend to another. But I really appreciate you bringing this up, because we do need to have that for ourselves. And when I said, can we go back to that place of saying, good job, remember our sila, remember our good work, that is also the way that we strengthen that joy for our own work, that appreciation for our own work. And I tend to use the word appreciative joy or vicarious joy and not sympathetic joy. And this is just a semantic preference on my part, because I think of if I can appreciate your successes, to me it's different than sympathizing. You know, it's a word choice. But vicarious joy is I can feel joy and have that joy stimulated in me because of what you are experiencing. And that's what we did when we started our morning today, when I said, find out what brings that other person joy and notice how you feel. That's what we were doing, was experiencing mudita, planting those seeds. But this is, I don't mean to make it sound simplistic, because this is complex. This is not so easy to do. Is that a helpful response?
Yes, and another thing was she cautioned us against trying to go beyond our immediate capacity.
Exactly. That's why we talk about capacity.
Yeah.
Because it might not always be there. And so if what we feel is jealousy, envy, resentment, just to know that. And we don't have to be hard on ourselves when we say, why not me? Then, right there, that's where we bring ourselves some loving kindness. Oh, dear, you're hurting. Yeah, may I be at ease right in this moment. And this is how we need all of these practices, to be able to say, what do I need right in this moment? Mudita is not available to me. I need some loving kindness. I think mudita is very complex. That's why I want to really talk about it. And we do need the supports of the others. So it is about capacity. It is about perspective. What we don't want, what I want to caution about, the trick here is not planting the seeds of ill will. When we feel that piece of envy, jealousy, resentment, just know it's there, but not feed it. Because it's harder for that to get uprooted. And this is where we get into the aspect of wise effort, which is knowing the state of mind and heart and not cultivating these negative states that ultimately can harm us or others. But seeing it in us and having some self-compassion for our humanness in it. So as an example, many years ago, some of you know that for many years I owned a laundromat, which I've recently just sold. Yeah. There are always laundry stories, don't worry. Don't worry, I'm full of them. But so my store I'm not doing it anymore because I'm doing this. It's a big neighborhood laundromat in a college town, and when I was starting, the day before that store opened, almost 21 years to the day, actually, August 1998, a very dear friend of mine came by and said to me, as she was looking around, I had put enormous effort into building out this store and starting it, she said to me, your success makes me feel badly about myself. Ouch, right? Big time, ouch. That happened 21 years ago, and I've never forgotten it. That is not mudita. right? What I wanted more than anything in that moment was mudita. This was one of my closest friends who was reflecting back to me her feelings of less than for herself. And I took it personally, right? Because I didn't have the capacity or the perspective at that time to see that this was a reflection of her suffering, of her limited capacity and perspective. And so to say that to me was, it changed our friendship completely, because then I felt like I was walking on eggshells for the next 20 years. And so, you know, having, this is how we get back to wise speech. We don't always say, tell the other person how we feel, right? So our practice is complex and it's completely interconnected. Every single one of these practices needs another to be supported and to reflect back to each other. Let's fast forward 21 years, and I just completed leading a hiking retreat in Colorado just a few weeks ago. It was this very beautiful hut-to-hut hiking retreat, and it was just eight of us because the huts only hold eight people, so it was very small. And this same friend who has since moved away came on this retreat with me. And I hadn't seen her in about a year, and I didn't know that she had any kind of meditation practice, but it was just a burgeoning practice, and she said, I want to come on this. And great. And truth be told, I was a little bit nervous about it because I didn't want to feel judged, right? You know, I mean, that was that judgment. I wanted to go there and teach and just be me. And my favorite place in the world is high up in the mountains. And so I knew I was going into a place where I have access to my best self, and getting to hike and teach and bring this practice into that environment is really the cherry on top. You know, for me, it's really the best. And so I was a little bit nervous about it. And as it turned out, it was great. You know, she loved it. It was fine. And I got to teach Sylvia's teaching to all of us. May I meet this moment fully. May I meet it as a friend. So if you've been here with Sylvia Boorstein, you know that she's given us a very great gift in that practice. May I meet this moment fully. May I meet it as a friend. So my friend who was there loved that. And it really was the thing that she could hold on to as a piece of wisdom practice. And in the mail the other day came this beautiful package of a picture of one of the most beautiful vistas that we had, that she had framed, and on it she had printed, may I meet this moment fully, may I meet it as a friend, Sylvia Boorstein. And it's going to make me all teary now, but she wrote me a card and said, you're really in where you belong. And so she was able to also come from 22 years ago, from that place of about her pain, to be to mudita. Isn't that the best? And this is possible. This is what I mean about where this practice takes us. If we let it, if we can just stick with it, step by step, just bit by bit. Mark Nepo says, what would we have to water within us and between us to grow something holy enough that would keep us from hurting each other? This is it. This is what we're doing here. Last story. Oh my goodness, yes. And then we'll open it up. A year ago, my son got married. And it was very joyful, of course. And my mom is here, so she got to be there too, which is great. And, you know, after the ceremony and we're in the reception, people were giving toasts, and it was my turn to give a toast, and I didn't really think too much about everything that I was going to say. But what I mostly wanted to do was give a little dharmet. And what I did say is, you know, I pointed out that here we are here to celebrate these two beautiful humans who we all love so much. And notice, I did the same thing I did this morning. Notice how you feel right now. Isn't that good? Notice that feeling in your heart. So when times are difficult, you can go back to that. You can come right back to this evening of celebrating Jacob and Liz's love and how we are all here doing that. And can we use that joy as an act of resistance? And everybody loved it. And then Liz, my new daughter-in-law, came over and gave me a big hug. She said, "Oh my God, I'm getting that tattooed on my butt." Which I don't think she has, but if she has, I don't know about it. So this is my point, is we need joy. We need to feel these places of uplift because they change us and they support us. They will change our world. They can. And we grow with that. It's healing and it's really beautiful. So, Leonard Cohen gets the last word. "I greet you from the other side of sorrow and despair with a love so vast and shattered it will reach you everywhere." That's what we're doing. So let's open it up and talk with each other.
Can you repeat that?
Sure. "I greet you from the other side of sorrow and despair with a love so vast and shattered it will reach you everywhere." So, who's got something you'd like to share?
I do. I want to say, I'm over here.
Oh, there you are.
I was just going to say that that last statement makes me feel that I have a lot of power.
Yeah.
And to say, "Whoa, I can do that. I can be that." It's awesome.
It is. Thank you. We should never doubt our capacity, the impact that we can have in our lives. It's a big deal. What we do matters. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, over here.
Years ago, I saw on television there were four Tibetan monks that were traveling around here. And one of them, there was room for only one of them to go up in Napa Valley in a hot air balloon. And a reporter talked to the other three and said, "Oh, are you sorry that there wasn't room for all of you?" And the one said, "Oh no, our brother will enjoy it for all of us."
And I'm sure he meant that. That's it. Yeah. He can get out of his own way and really feel that. Thank you. What's your name?
My name's Greg.
Greg, thank you. Right here.
Thank you very much. I was thinking about the type of joy you were talking about when you're just letting go and releasing and not fighting life and not resisting. And my own mother was 99 when she passed 2 years ago. And she was radiant because she had, most of everything in the world had fallen away.
Mm-hmm.
All her friends, all her associations, everything. But she was in this state of just keeping letting go. And it made her radiant, where I would see people around her resisting life. And it was such a different experience. So that very simple act is a very powerful.
Thank you.
Letting go.
Yeah, what is your name?
Lenny. And thank you for your whole...
Oh, you're welcome. May we all be so lucky, though, to be able to do that kind of letting go. Yeah, thank you.
Hi. I think one of the things I'm taking away, especially from the exercise at the beginning, is that when you're in... embodied presence with another person and they're feeling joy, it's actually very hard to not feel joy. And that the, for me, the envy will arise. It's not so much about joy. It's about a narrative about success, someone else's success. And that actually feels very different than joy. But if I'm witnessing another person in joy, the connection is there. The problem happens if I make up a story about a certain accomplishment or outcome, assume the person's feeling joy around that, and then feel very disconnected from them or that state.
I think it's a very astute observation, because when you said, when I'm just witnessing it, I can feel it. And the reason is that we have mirror neurons, which are antenna, that we all know, that we feel. You come into a room and you can feel the energy in the room. And when it's joyous, it feels great. And when it's tense, you know, we shrink back. But we don't not feel it. And maybe we're not aware. Some of us have more awareness than others. But you're right to say, when I just feel it and witness it, I feel it. And it goes away as soon as I start making up a story about it, because the mind gets in the way. It just starts conceptualizing it instead of just being in the more organic, primal experience of it. And that's what we're trying to get to, is that awareness, that deeper awareness. Tell me your name, please.
Tara.
Tara, thank you. Yeah. Diane, right here.
I had the honor of my career for many years as a labor and delivery nurse. And one of the things that I learned from my patients really was reflected in something you said about, you know, the whatever makes that little weed push through the cement that we all have. And I saw it time after time when a woman was pushing her child out and would fall back in the bed and just be like, I'm completely spent, I can't. And then they'd get another contraction and go right back into it. And that profoundly affected me when I had a very challenging chapter of ovarian cancer several years ago in the midst of a divorce, and kept falling back, and I'm like, I can't show up to another day of this suffering, and remembering what I saw with every single woman who said she couldn't and always could. And I just was really reflecting that we all have that one more push in us.
Thank you so much. It is so true. And I'm glad you're here and well. Because we can go through these incredible times. And if we are lucky enough, by some grace of luck sometimes, we get through that.
And that's the joy.
That is.
Reflecting back.
That's right.
Being like, oh, yes, I did. Oh,
you
yes,
did.
She did.
Exactly.
Oh, yes, he did.
Yeah. Yeah, what a great thing, you know, see women giving birth, and that's there you go. Over and over and over again. So for all of us women who have given birth, remember we did it. Yes, thank you. Yeah.
Not being one of that group, I still try and struggle with the mudita and developing more mirror neurons. And my daughter is 27 in New York and getting ready to get married, I think. I don't like it. And I need to develop some empathy and some not sympathy, but some empathetic joy about the upcoming relationship she has with her soon-to-be husband, my guess is. And it's a struggle.
Yeah,
it's a constant struggle, and I have to keep very quiet about it within the confines of the familial relationships.
That's really hard, isn't it? That's very difficult. And so, tending first to your own heart, to the struggle itself of going into something that is really uncomfortable, that you're unhappy about, and you don't have control. Right? And that's the piece, right? Right there. That's the piece of working towards letting go and hoping that she's very happy. You know, that she really is making a choice that's going to be for her well-being, for her sustained well-being. And that as parents, we don't get to choose. They're really hard. Yeah. Lots of metta for you. Yeah.
It actually makes me laugh. As my father was opening the last bottle of champagne at my wedding, he was overheard to say to one of his good friends, "Well, I guess I didn't look like much at 26 either."
And on that note, I guess I didn't look like much at 26 either. That's really great. So let's just all be quiet for about 30 seconds here. With great joy and appreciation to all of you who have come here today and shared your practice and with your attentive hearts and minds and your kindness, take that in. Take in what you've heard and what we've shared. Let it drop in. From the Buddha, live in joy, in love, even among those who hate. Live in joy, in health, even among the afflicted. Live in joy, in peace, even among the troubled. Look within, be still, free from fear and attachment. Know the sweet joy of the way. Be safe, be well, enjoy each other. I'll be back in 2 weeks.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.